Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Trying something a little different today. I'm in the Savannah Bureau of GPB. Came down here today. The Savannah Rotary, the downtown Rotary here, asked me to come down and talk to them. And I've just finished that. And I must say, it's really gratifying to know that they like Political Rewind over at the Savannah Rotary. So I'm here in Savannah, and joining me in the Savannah studio, one of our panelists, Dr. Laura Wessel. She's an associate professor of political science at Armstrong State University. Thanks for coming on the show today. You keep me from being alone in this studio, Laura.
Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure.
Back in Atlanta, of course, the lead writer, political writer for the AJC, Jim Galloway, is with us. He is in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. And, of course, he oversees Politically Georgia, the new political website, blog that the AJC's put out. How are you, Jim?
We're doing fine. How are things down on the coast? You sound good. You sound close.
Yeah, you do, too. You know, I'm a Chicago boy. The heat here is a little harder for me, but obviously Savannah is a beautiful city. You're joined up there by Senator Elena Parent, Democratic senator from DeKalb County, Decatur. Elena, thank you for being back on the show
today. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
And Republican strategist Brian Robinson is with us. Brian, of course, former deputy chief of staff and communications director for Governor Nathan Deal. And, you know, we never say, Brian, that before that you had an actual career on the Hill where you worked for Congressman Lynn Westmoreland. So you have Washington and Georgia chops.
That's right, man. I've been all over the place. And don't forget, I used to work at the AJC, too.
That's right. You were at the AJC.
We try to tap that down a little bit.
Yeah, they've whitewashed that history.
Yeah, we don't want to.
They want to erase that history.
And I think between you and Greg Bluestein, you are the two probably most devoted Bulldog fans on the Political Rewind team.
It would be pretty hard to get to the right of me on that. And I ran into Greg actually at the game Saturday in his Greg Blue jersey. And so he was all decked out and ready to go, and the Dogs delivered another big win for us.
Yeah. Well, congratulations for all you Georgia fans out there. Laura Wessel here in Savannah is kind of shaking her head. But Ken Armstrong State doesn't have a football team.
I grew up in Ohio. I have my own problems.
Oh, okay. So let's, you know, unfortunately, we've had to do this before. We put the show together, producer Tom Faust and I talk about what we think the topics ought to be, panelists contribute to what they'd like to talk about. And then once again, over the weekend, yesterday, another just awful, tragic shooting, this time at a church in a tiny little town in Texas. And Jim, we've just heard the news, you know, of course the shooter is dead. And Jim, of course, the first question is always, why did this happen? What was the motivation? And we've learned this morning that apparently there was trouble between the shooter and at least his mother-in-law, who he had sent some threatening notes to, right?
Right. It looks like the in-laws, this is the former in-laws, went to this church, but they were not there on Sunday.
So once again, we try to confront what we do in this country about shootings like this. Laura, you are teaching a course on the presidency, on U.S. presidents this semester.
I am.
Last night, President Trump, we heard him at the very top of the show, say from Japan, this is a problem, this is an issue of mental health. It is not an issue of guns. What role do you think a president has in moments like this in terms of helping guide us to where we need to get to go on an issue like this?
Well, he has a couple of roles. First of all, he's the consoler in chief and needs to, you know, use that language, use that rhetoric that brings the country together in a difficult time. In addition, he's viewed as, you know, the policy leader, especially of the Republican Party, and so people are going to look to him in terms of what direction the government might take or might not take.
So, Elena, when the president says this is a mental health issue, not a gun issue, what do you come away thinking?
Well, I just think that's sort of laughable because there are mental health problems all over the world, and America is quite unique in these sorts of mass shootings and the level of gun violence that we have.
So, okay, let's go around on that. Brian, at a certain point, after Las Vegas, after this, after Sandy Hook, I mean, we've seen these things happen more and more often. And one of the things that, and I think it is safe to say, and you'll correct me, Brian, if you don't think I'm correct, it's Republicans who often say, it's not time to talk about guns. It's not time to raise issues. We're in mourning right now. When is it the correct time, and where do you think we ought to be in regard to the president saying this is mental health, not guns?
Well, it is an ongoing conversation at all times. Republicans just, I think, get irritated by the fact that the media response to every one of these is, oh, we need to have stricter gun controls. Republicans don't see the world that way. We don't see it as gun control is going to solve this issue, but that is the basis for many of the questions that come from the media. The people who are asking the questions, they believe in gun control, and they are driving that agenda.
Wait, are you suggesting that you don't think it's appropriate for reporters in response to another mass shooting to wonder if perhaps we ought to be looking at stricter regulations about guns? I just want to make sure I know where you stand on that.
You can ask all the questions that you want, but please understand the way that Republicans see it in the direction that we're coming from is we get asked these questions after one of these shootings, almost as if we're responsible for them because of these policy decisions. And it's just, it's exhausting. And there's it's really hard to discuss it within a media atmosphere where the people asking the questions already have an opinion.
Jim, you're one of those media people.
I'm one of those media people, and the thing that really hurts about this Texas incident is that you can feel us getting used to it. That it's not the outrage that we saw 35 days ago in Las Vegas isn't there. And to Brian's point is if this is, you know, if restrictions of guns is not the answer, and if mental health is the answer, as Mr. Trump says, and then that's basically a way of saying this is something we're going to have to live with, and you can see it on the internet, on tweets and Facebook, where you've got people saying this is the price that we have to pay for our gun freedom. And if that's the case, then I think we need to really start looking at our language, because the victims that are being shot are not victims. They're acceptable damage.
Oh. Ugh. You know, Laura, do you want to weigh in?
Collateral damage.
In my opinion, it's a gun issue. It's a mental health issue. Most policy problems don't result from one issue. Can we not talk about guns and mental health in the same conversation? Yeah. I know Republicans who support some reasonable regulations. I know Democrats with strong support for the Second Amendment.
You know, Elena, I want to tell you about the world that I saw.
Less and less, though. It's more and more polarized where just like with everything, this issue is like every other issue is becoming, whether it's immigration, whether it's taxes, whether it is Medicaid expansion, whether it is abortion. There are tribalized sides now.
That's exactly what I wanted to mention, Brian. I'm glad you brought that up. Elena, I lived in two different worlds here in Savannah this morning. I woke up in my hotel room, and I turned on the news. And for part of the time, I watched Morning Joe. I watched Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough and their panel. And their show was all about how we need stricter gun laws. And there wasn't a single person on the panel who thought that wasn't the way to begin addressing this problem. And then, as I often do, turned over to Fox and Friends, the president's favorite show, because I thought I should hear what they're saying. And on Fox and Friends, the person who they introduced just as I turned the channel was the attorney general of the state of Texas, who said the problem here is that there aren't enough guns out there. We need more guns to protect ourselves against dangerous individuals like the shooters that have been wreaking havoc recently. And he pointed out that in this incident yesterday, it was a man with a long gun outside the church who confronted the shooter. The shooter dropped his gun and fled. I'm living in two universes within 10 minutes on a morning news show. And so Brian's right, Elena. We're so polarized. The question is whether we're ever going to move forward on an issue like this.
Right. I mean, I do think that Americans, by and large, do not agree with the easy accessibility of these types of weapons that can inflict mass casualties in a matter of seconds. And that's been the case for many years. And I think that's, you know, whether, you know, you don't really need to talk about whether people are allowed to have a handgun in their home, but discussing, you know, for example, this guy, bought this rifle and then put a picture of it on Facebook.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Too bad the mother-in-law wasn't monitoring that page. Believe me, if my son-in-law did that, I would have some questions.
But the problem, Bill, here is that we are even polarized on what I would think would be the most basic questions. I mean, now, again, the reports out of Texas are unclear. The first ones that I heard were that the fellow was shooting from the outside through the walls into the church.
Yes.
And that brings up kind of what kind of ammunition did he have? And we can't even get a consensus on whether armor-piercing ammunition should be banned in this country.
Right, and these types of very deadly military weapons that I mentioned.
Or the ballistic vests that this fellow apparently was wearing. And that's, you know, if you're on the law enforcement side of this, that's very troubling.
Yeah. So let me, to close out this portion of the conversation, ask a question. Jim, let me start with you, but then Elena, you need to weigh in on this. It doesn't seem likely that this incident is suddenly going to lead to a serious effort to do anything about gun laws. But the question is whether it may have some impact on expanding gun rights. So, Jim, with that in mind, the legislature, certainly we expect that pro-gun activists are going to come back to do even more to provide opportunities for guns to be carried everywhere, really, in the state. But is that going to happen, or is that going to be shut down because of incidents like this?
Number one, I think if the last version gun bill that was passed, and Brian can correct me if I'm wrong, it permitted weapons to be carried in churches, concealed weaponry in churches, as long as the church is fine, which is a property rights issue.
Right, the church gets it aside. Yeah.
Right. The only thing that seems to be in flux right now is making it harder for university presidents to kind of chart out the areas where guns are not allowed, and I think that might be it's a very nuanced area that I'm not expecting anything big. Do I think that this shooting will change anything in the legislature? No, not at all.
Elena?
No, I don't think it will either. But I just find it interesting Brian's comment about, oh, all these questions are exhausting. You know what I find exhausting is all these mass shootings. And it is just, you know, it's so funny thinking of it from the, and I've thought this way since I was a little girl, from the, I guess we don't get on the left side, to us it's so unbelievably obvious that more guns cause more deaths because it's just how it is. And anyone with a brain knows that. And it's so crazy.
I so appreciate Elena making my point for me. That is why Republicans don't want to have this discussion, because to her and to them, it is so, quote, unbelievably obvious. Why should we engage in that debate? Why should we engage in that when we're talking to people who, from the start, inherently disagree with us on this? Look, gun control, background checks, all that stuff would not have prevented this from happening. There are 300 million weapons in American homes
today.
That's
the problem.
And what are we going to do?
And that is the only
raid homes and
to
take
me,
them?
That's the only valid argument that your side can possibly bring to the table, is that it's so insane that there's literally nothing you can do about it. But that's not where I come as a policymaker.
As a policymaker, what you would do would be to restrict the access of new people to get them. And that's going to create a black market for what's already out there. And again, bad guys will have them, good guys won't.
I guess if that were evident anywhere else in the world, I might agree with you. But it's not.
All right, I'm going to step in. I think we have a fairly clear idea where you each stand on this issue. And it's a debate that will continue. But if Jim Galloway's right, it's not one that will get much traction down at the Georgia General Assembly.
Not when a governor's race is happening.
That's a really good point. All right, look, it's really time for us to get in our first break. So let's do that. And when we come back, we're going to move on. And we've got a couple of Savannah issues that really are impactful across the state. We'll talk about them when Political Rewind continues.
The Panama Papers exposed how dictators hide their wealth. Now, a new leak called the Paradise Papers shows who's profiting from island tax shelters.
Everything from Apple to Facebook, Walmart, Uber. What we are seeing is really industrial scale tax avoidance.
This week, Reveal joins the global hunt for answers.
Tune in tomorrow afternoon at 2 here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. As I said, I'm down in the Savannah Bureau hosting the show from here with props to Cindy Hill, who is producing the show from down here. We appreciate your help on this, Cindy. Those of you who don't live in Atlanta hear her on Morning Edition every day. She's a statewide host of the show. Laura Wessel from Armstrong State University down here in Savannah is with us. Brian Robinson, Elena Parent, and Jim Galloway back in Atlanta. Jim, let's turn to the Virginia governor's race, which is attracting an enormous amount of attention. They're voting tomorrow. And I want to talk about it briefly because it actually introduces a subject that's very relevant to what's going on here in Savannah and that has impact around the state. So, with a day left, it appears that this race is virtually a dead heat, even though the polls tend to show Democrat Ralph Northam up a couple points over Republican Ed Gillespie. But it really appears to be anybody's race at this point, doesn't it?
Right. And if I had to say one of the two has momentum, I would say it's Ed Gillespie.
Yeah, he's come on strong. He was at one point behind by in double digits in many of the polls. And what's interesting, and the reason I say it has relevance down here and across Georgia, is that one of the issues that Gillespie has used to gain that momentum is he's hammering away at the importance of protecting and preserving Confederate memorials and monuments in the state of Virginia. That and the fact that Northam is closing this race in running a pretty poor campaign, but the Confederate issue has really come to the forefront.
Right, and it's something that you wouldn't expect in a post-Charlottesville situation,
yeah.
but it's counterintuitive, and they've been helped a little bit by Democrats in the race. There's a Latino group that has put out an internet-based ad in which a white fellow in a pickup truck flying a Confederate battle emblem is chasing kids through a neighborhood of kids of color through a neighborhood, and that has really it's focused the fervor of the GOP, I think, a little bit.
I think that's
right. It's so inflammatory, you know, and it those type of things do a great job of mobilizing the other party. When you run an ad saying that if you vote for Ed Gillespie, you are ergo a racist, which is what that ad says, you are going to mobilize Gillespie's voters better than he ever could on his own.
All right, so Laura, the relevance here is right now you and Savannah have a couple of issues that relate to Confederate. One big issue that relates to Confederate imagery, and that's you have a statue, a Confederate statue, in the middle of your Forsyth Park.
We do,
and there's a great concern. It's what Stan Deaton of the Georgia History Center, who I was with just a little while ago, says. It's funereal. It is not a battle statue.
It's not a word you hear every day.
Yeah, right. Nevertheless, there's controversy over whether that should come down, right?
There is. These monuments are symbols. They're symbols of identity. And when it comes to politics and election campaigns, it's easier to take a symbol that's easily understood by the citizenry and focus on that issue instead of getting into tax reform, which might have more relevancy to people's everyday lives, but is a lot more complex and frankly, not as interesting.
And Elena, you are dealing with that issue in the city of Decatur. Tell us about that.
There is a lost cause Confederate obelisk in Decatur Square. I believe it's owned by DeKalb County, although I think the county is still finalizing the details on that. And it's got some language on it that's, well, it was put, it was put up during Jim Crow. It was not in the, yes, it was not in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. It was put up in Jim Crow. Apparently a lot of Confederate statues and symbols were put up in that era. And again, during civil rights. And, you know, again, apparently courthouses, I've learned, were with some of the common locations of that they were erected in. And this one says something like the soldiers fought valiantly for the covenant-keeping race. And it's all a little bit weird, but the language is eyebrow-raising, to say the least.
And you are, and you want to see it come down in the
I want to give the community the power to decide for itself.
There you go. And Jim, that's what we get to now.
Right.
We've talked about this before. The state of Georgia has a statute which forbids local jurisdictions like Savannah, like the city of Decatur, from removing Confederate memorials, monuments, whatever, statues. The state has to do that, the legislature.
Right. It was part of the 2001 bargain to get rid of the 1956 segregation era state flag with the battle emblem.
All right. So you had a great item in Politically Georgia today in the Daily Jolt about how the Sons of Confederate Veterans are going to lobby against what Elena Parent and her colleagues in the legislature hope to do.
Yeah, they say they've hired a lobbyist, a professional lobbyist. We don't know who yet. I would no disrespect to Ms. Parent or Ms. Oliver, who is another sponsor of the bill, but they're Democrats, and you're waiting to see for who the Republican signer on the bill is before you kind of fire up your lobbying arm. But basically, they're saying, no, we don't want liberal mayors, liberal city council people, liberal county commissioners to have any sort of authority over the local statues. That's an argument that doesn't always sell well on the Republican side.
We've got GMA and ACCG.
GMA being the Georgia Municipal Association.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And Commissioners Association.
The other hotspot, of course, is the Stone Mountain Park, which is a state facility, and by law it serves as a memorial for Confederate dead.
Brian, where do Republicans want to come down on an issue like this? You're a strategist. You're a consultant. Where would you advise them to come down on this?
Okay. Well, this is complex, but Bill, hear me out.
All right. The clock is running.
Jim is right. This was part of a compromise to change the state flag. And, of course, that was one of the major downfalls of Roy Barnes as far as his electoral reelection prospects was changing the flag. This was part of that compromise. And it's not been even a full generation since then. We need to let that compromise stay in place. It was a measure of good faith, and let's keep that good faith. Two, Republican voters statewide feel fervently about this. You know, you talk about gun control. If you poll the country at large, you would see that a majority probably favors some measure of gun controls that are stricter than what we have now. But those who are against it are the most fervent against it. And Republicans in Georgia and in Virginia, we're seeing this issue play out in that race too. And that's a much more, quote, cosmopolitan state because of the D.C. suburbs. It really matters to Republican voters that these monuments be preserved. They don't want to see them taken down because they see it as a slippery slope. And you look at Stacey Abrams, the leading Democrat for governor in this state, and she's talking about sandblasting Stone Mountain. Republican voters hear that and think the left has gone absolutely mad.
Laura, so Brian makes a case for Republican voters, but what he's really... But I asked him that question in the context of his being a political consultant. So that's the advice he would give to a Republican candidate he was working for, say, in a legislative race.
And let me add that what I suggest candidates say is that I'm against erasing history, but I am for adding history.
All right. So, but Laura, he talked about a slippery slope. Do Republican elected officials really want to tie themselves to the Confederacy, however they try to contextualize it?
Well, the slippery slope argument can be applied to several of the issues that we've talked about or will be talking about today. Interestingly, I just had a student this morning ask, we were talking about ideology and what conservatives usually believe about the role of government versus liberals, and the conservative student said, you know, typically a conservative is going to want more state-level government, less federal government, so why are we not applying that same standard to this whole Confederacy thing? Why don't we want these decisions made at the local level instead of big state government? I wasn't sure how to answer the question.
Can I take a stab at that?
Sure.
You may.
if you take a Venn diagram and draw one circle for white Trump voters who feel threatened by demographics, by simply aging out of the population, and if you took another Venn diagram of those who are supporting Confederate monuments and Confederate heritage symbols, they would overlap, I think, almost 100%.
Agreed. It's fervent voter, that small percentage of fervent voters we're talking about compared to the majority of voters who are moderate.
And those voters run the Republican primary.
Elena, given what Jim Galloway just pointed out, what do you think your odds of your getting this bill passed? You and Mary Margaret, as he points out, two Democrats supporting this or sponsoring this?
Well, you know, I have to talk to some other folks. I think that the city of Kennesaw requested that legislation like this be passed. And, you know, it is a little ironic because it's the people that live in communities that see whatever statue or images have been erected in their own communities. It's not, you know, I don't go to Kennesaw very often. They don't need to come to Decatur and, you know, vice versa. So I do find it a little ironic that people would force the maintenance of one particular symbol in a community that they probably never go to.
My question is, do you think you can find a strong Republican signature on this bill that will help you pass it?
Yes, I do think I can, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, the whole conversation is, as Jim pointed out, a testament to changing demographics, people feeling very threatened, and white identity politics. And, you know, the reality is that it may necessitate a little more seeping into the general public before enough people know more facts about some of these monuments and therefore are maybe more ready to see some of them changed or modified or added to, as Brian said.
We got a lot more to cover, so I want to move on. I do want to mention, though, quickly, Laura, one other issue you're dealing with here. That's not about the Confederacy, but it's certainly about the days of the South that many people would like to put behind them. For decades, the bridge, the big, big bridge in Savannah has been called the Eugene Talmadge Bridge. Savannah City Council just voted a resolution asking the legislature to allow the name of that bridge to be changed to the Savannah Bridge because people here are now uncomfortable and probably have been for some time with the legacy of Eugene Talmadge, a Seg-style political leader of this state.
Correct. And so we're right back to the same discussion. You have a local government and at least a pretty big segment of the local population who are comfortable changing the name to the Savannah Bridge, feeling it's more reflective of the city. But the state legislature ultimately is going to have a say in that.
And I think, Bill, that one is probably a little bit harder lift than the Confederate issue, simply because the Talmadge legacy is still in the Capitol. You have his grandson is a lobbyist down here. The grandson of Herman Talmadge is a lobbyist down here.
Right. So we're going to watch all that. Interesting times in Savannah, Laura.
It's interesting. Interesting is a good word to use.
All right. Let's do this. Let's get our second break out of the way so we can come back and talk about any number of other issues, including a column that you wrote the other day, Galloway. You gave us a little preview on Friday, but now we can flesh it out. A new effort to get Medicaid funded by Obamacare, but there's a very specific thrust this time. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Lewis, author of Moneyball, talks about the uneasy transition in federal agencies when Trump administration appointees arrived. Lewis says many career civil servants found Trump officials unprepared and uninterested in the work of the departments. He writes about the potential consequences in a series for Vanity Fair. Join us.
Fresh Air, 3 o'clock this afternoon, here on listener-supported GPB.
We're back on.
People have a huge need to feel superior.
We're back on Political Rewind. That was Elena Parent. I heard you from all the way here in Savannah.
Sorry about that.
The debate does not stop.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, people, if you could only be standing in the control room watching through the glass, you'd see people keep at it. And I'm here in Savannah, but I suspect that Brian Robinson and Elena Parent particularly may be getting into a significant fight during
No. We were totally on the same page, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you were? Okay.
That's a secret for all the air. Elena Parent.
He doesn't know what we were talking about.
Jim, by the way, Laura Wessel from Armstrong State University, political science professor, is with me in Savannah. Jim, obviously for several years now, since the Obamacare allowed for states to expand Medicaid using federal dollars, there's been some conversation about it in Georgia. Never gone very far. Governor Deal has been against it from the get-go. But now there's an interesting twist that you wrote about in your column this weekend. A very conservative state senator thinks it's a good idea if it addresses a very big problem.
As long as you don't use the word Medicaid expansion. And basically what this is, I mean, this is the first anniversary of Trump's election this week, I think on Wednesday.
Wednesday.
On the Wednesday it'll be. But that election also killed a kind of a embryonic attempt to expand Medicaid, where you had the Georgia Chamber kind of putting together a triplicate of options for when Hillary Clinton got into the White House and kept Obamacare going. Obviously, that hasn't happened. We're still seeing efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, but you do have an effort in the legislature building in no small part because you've got rural hospitals collapsing and any kind of extra federal funding is going to help them. But Renee Underman, the chairman of the Senate Health Committee, is trying to persuade the governor's people and a few other state capital leaders to seek a waiver, is what she's calling it, for a Medicaid program that would help the state address the opioid epidemic.
And one of the things I thought, Brian, was interesting about Galloway's column was he quoted Senator Unterman, and I'm not going to be exact, of course, but essentially she said, for the time being at least, this debate over repeal and replace is over with. Obamacare is the law of the land, so let's at least get something out of it, and addressing opioids with expanded Medicaid may be a good thing that we can get from it.
You know, here's the issue, is last year when those plans were put together, it did seem fairly certain that Hillary Clinton would win. I think it took everybody, even Republicans, by surprise that Republicans did as well last year as they did. And so there was hope, and everything got put on hold because we had to wait to see what Congress was going to do. And now I think people are losing hope that Congress is going to do what they promised to do and repeal and replace because, you know, as the president said, who knew health care was so complicated? I mean, it was a complete surprise. But here's the thing. We will continue to lose rural hospitals. And I'm not talking about as a Republican or a Democrat, whatever. Here's the reality. We're going to continue to lose rural hospitals because we have too many unpaying patients. As Jim had in his column, I believe, Senator Unterman said that uncompensated care keeps her up at night. That's a major a major issue. And so we're losing a lot of our health care infrastructure, and this would inject some money into it. Now, there is a downside. We are expanding the welfare state, and that does have tax implications. But this is a serious conversation that we need to have in 2019, because let me tell you, it ain't going to happen during an election year in 2018.
Laura, what's the you've got opioid problems here in Savannah, just as they do everywhere.
Sure, we do. And, in terms of the politics of it, are we going? It's, you know, similar to the mental health question with guns. If we're going to put government efforts towards this, be it through Medicaid or through some state-funded program, it's going to cost money. And with an election coming up next year, Republicans in particular face the difficult challenge of explaining the conservative point of view of not wanting to increase spending while at the same time tackling some of these issues that are expensive.
Elena, let me give you the very last word on this. Renee Untram, this is a measure that you and your colleagues, Democratic colleagues in the Senate, I assume, can get behind in a heartbeat.
Sure. I mean, I think our position would be sort of, as Brian alluded to, look, this is already the law. You know, we're already paying the taxes. Our state should receive the benefit. So we'd like it to be as broad a benefit to Georgia citizens as possible.
Okay. Let's move on. We're going to go back and do some a few items back in Washington, and then we're going to close with the Atlanta mayor's race. Because Atlantans go to the polls tomorrow. Real quickly, Jim, they're marking up the House's tax reform plan starting this afternoon, we're told. They hope to do it during regular business hours. That's silly. That'll never happen.
No.
Because they believe they're going to get it out by Thursday. So we may be, if they do what they say they're going to do, by next week, the debate over the tax reform bill should be in full roar in the United States House.
It should be, and I would expect a fairly easy passage there.
Yeah.
If Paul Ryan can get all his ducks in a row, with the understanding that they'll have at least two more chances to change to fiddle with it, with all the portions of it. Your problem comes when it gets to the Senate.
Yeah, you know, so let's talk about that very briefly. Friday on the show, I suggested that by the time when it gets to the Senate, they're going to rip up the House bill and start all over again. And most of the talk this weekend suggested that very well might be exactly what they're going to do.
And there are plenty of issues out there. I mean, your small business community is upset with what's out there.
Yeah.
Especially people who have businesses, service businesses like Mr. Robinson over here. He's greatly affected by this.
I would love to see Brian Robinson out there opposing this tax bill.
Well, just because it doesn't go far enough. See, right. that would be right up his alley.
That's all right. All right. Well, we'll watch how that unfolds. Jim, let me stick with you because I want to talk about Donna Brazile. This story, it seems to get stranger by the day. Donna Brazile, the acting chair of the Democratic National Committee after Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to step down, she's now written the memoir. We talked about it on the show the other day. She suggested in the articles and the interview she's given, the memoir hasn't hit the streets yet, but she first suggested that the Clinton campaign, essentially by bailing the Democratic National Committee out of its financial problems, took control of the party even before she was the nominee, and she certainly suggested it allowed them to kind of rig this thing for Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders. Now she backed away this weekend saying, well, that's not really what they did. But now she's added this other twist, which is I thought for a while that I might have to remove Hillary Clinton as the nominee when she faded after the 9/11 commemoration ceremony in downtown New York. I thought I was going to have to replace her with Joe Biden. Well, first of all, I don't think a DNC chair has the power to remove a nominee.
Yep.
And second, this, what do we make of it? Laura, you're shaking your head. Go ahead, Jim.
First of all, a candidate propping up a political party is not all that unusual. All you have to do is look at the Georgia GOP over the course of the last, say, 8 years. And you would see governors propping that up and expecting a certain amount of loyalty in return for that. The more I look at, hear about this Donna Brazile, Hillary Clinton stuff, the more I'm seeing a personal feud.
Yeah.
And with a subtext of wanting to make sure that the Clinton machine is not a part of the 2020 contest.
Yeah. Laura, you were shaking your head when I was talking about Donna Brazile a second ago.
I was just thinking about how we emphasize, you know, fractures within the Republican Party so much. Clearly there are fractures in the Democratic Party as well with an election coming up next year.
You know what's interesting about this to me? I've covered Donna Brazile since she was part of, people don't know that, realize this, she worked for Jesse Jackson in the 1984 presidential election cycle. And so, Laura, the reason I mention that is you know, today we may look at Donna and think, this is sort of a mainstream Democrat, somebody who gets along with people in the party. But she was a disruptor for the first part of her career, working with Jesse Jackson. She has that in her bloodstream. It isn't completely surprising it emerges all these years later.
No, she was a disruptor who became very much a part of the establishment. There's been a movement by some Democrats for decades now to disassemble the Clinton establishment, if that's the right word for it. And, you know, maybe she's been a part of that group. I haven't read the memoir yet, but clearly there's room for making up on both sides of the aisle.
Elena, as a Democrat, this has got to be distressing to you. I mean, you don't need this.
No. The less divisions that erupt into the public and get everyone in a froth, the better, you know, normally, right? So, but, you know, I don't think it's, yeah, I mean, the way the news has sort of trickled out was a little bit perplexing, but the more I read about it, some of it seemed a little strange, but as Jim already pointed out, some of these joint fundraising agreement things are pretty common.
Yeah, but Galloway, this thing could really, really, it's a bombshell right in the middle of the Democratic Party's leadership as they need to get their act together, not just for 2018, but start thinking 2020.
Yeah, but it's if you're going to have something like this, let's have it in the first 9 months of a Trump White House.
Right. That's,
and
okay.
And you know, I mean, there's some talk that it could flow into the Virginia race tomorrow. I just don't I don't think there's not enough time for that to penetrate.
Okay. See, I think that is something that's going to play in Ed Gillespie the Republican's favor in Virginia, because this has trickled down onto the state level. You know, Democracy for America, the left-wing group founded by Howard Dean, came out against the Democratic nominee this week.
Well, not against him. They said they
unendorsed, which was something that...
So who are they for, then? I mean, they never
endorsed him to begin with. They were just simply saying they're against him. That's the de facto.
Well, that is obviously... Outcome. That is one of those groups that is like... It's like the Freedom From Reality Caucus in the... Freedom Caucus in the GOP. They all behave right. Like that on the left.
Yeah, we both have them.
Okay.
Yeah.
We both have them.
Yeah, I think it's...
Right.
Look, the Democrats have not got their act together any better than Republicans trying to figure out where they stand in regard to Donald Trump. All right. Look, the Atlanta mayor's race is... You know, it's funny. At the Savannah Rotary, I said we're very mindful of the fact that we're statewide. How many of you in here really like it when we talk about the Atlanta mayor's race? And I was amazed. A good half or more of the people raised their hands. So this is for you, Savannah Rotary. Jim... I got to say, it with 80,000 people maybe turning out to vote, despite the polling, it strikes me that we have no idea how this thing is going to turn out. Am I being naive?
Well, I think just given the low energy of this whole contest, the fact that you've got, 13 people on the ballot,
that 12
people.
That is a significant factor, I think.
And that's kind of discouraging. If early voting has been dismal all across the board. So
everyone's still trying to figure out who the heck to vote for of the plethora of
you could have a very low turnout race, which could really upset the polling that we've seen from Mark Roundtree in Landmark's communication.
Yeah.
Which actually kind of is very interesting in that it shows Keisha Lance Bottoms, councilwoman, endorsed by Mayor Reed, going ahead of Mary Norwood, another councilwoman who faced Reed in 2009.
I talked to one of Kathy Willard's most loyal supporters this morning. I got a call.
Yes,
saying,
we know who that is.
I don't think it's a problem to say it's Beth Shapiro. She's a panelist on the show with some regularity. She's a very proud Mary Norwood supporter. And her argument...
Well, Kathy Willard!
What did I say? I meant Kathy Willard. I apologize. She says that they know where their votes are, they know how to go after them, that they've had good early voting returns from the areas they think matter, and she thinks with 15,000 to 18,000 votes, you can get into the runoff. You know, I don't know whether that's possible or not, but it is astonishing that it's possible to get into a race with under 20,000 votes after $10 million have been spent on this thing.
Yeah, I would say, there are probably four candidates who could possibly make it into the runoff, and that would be Bottoms, Norwood, Peter Amon, and Kathy Wooler.
All right, hey Laura, what are you down here? We're heading it. You've elected a white mayor in Atlanta,
in Savannah.
here in Savannah. Mayor DeLoach, first white mayor in a considerable amount of time. As you look north to the Atlanta mayor's race, what are your thoughts as you see that this could come down to a contest? It's once again splitting the city between potentially a white candidate and an African-American candidate in a runoff.
It's something that seems more and more common. It's something that seems symbolic of what's going on at the state level and at the national level. And I think it's such a difficult issue that we tend to just not talk about it rather than face it head on because we're worried about offending people. I have students say that. We don't want to talk about race because we don't want to make somebody mad. We'd rather just pretend it's not an issue.
Yeah. Brian,
I think there are silver linings there because what it shows, the fact that you've got a white candidate that is viable, and in fact, as Jim just mentioned, there are three white candidates that are viable. It shows that the city is re-diversifying after the ravages of segregation when there was such white flight out of the city. It shows that we've got a very diverse city. And let me tell you, there's probably going to be one white person and one African-American in the runoff, and both of them will get cross-racial votes. Now, not the majority, nowhere close to a majority, but they will. Mary Norwood has consistently, even running against African-American candidates for the at-large city council seat that she owns, holds, has won very high margins of African-American votes. See, I think that there is hope in what's happening in Atlanta. It's not just a symbol of the tribalism. And let me add that if you are undecided going into tomorrow, go to the Committee for a Better Atlanta website, and you can see what each candidate had said in a questionnaire. You can judge for yourself and just look at the city council president, mayor, and your city council race, and it'll give you the information you need to make an informed decision very fast.
All right. So that's an interesting point because, Jim, you've moderated at least one, I think more than one forum. I've moderated a number of them. I don't know how you vote on issues in this race because those forums have not shown a whole lot of daylight among any of these candidates.
There is a slight difference in how they talk about MARTA and transit.
Yeah.
There's a slight difference in how they view the authority of the Atlanta Board of Education, but only slight. There are a few policy differences as far as housing goes and the lack of affordable housing that's developing within the city. But I think this is why the corruption issue has gotten so big in this race, where you've got three federal investigations happening at once. And that's because it's just kind of the general ennui. It kind of captures the tone and the mood more so than any one particular issue.
Elena, we haven't heard you weigh in on this.
No, I think Jim is exactly right. I think it's been very difficult for anyone people to really distinguish themselves, which has blown the corruption issue up. I think it's driven turnout probably down. I think there are probably a lot of folks who are kind of throwing their hands up and maybe are going to vote in the runoff. We'll see. But the one good thing I would say is it does seem like we have a strong slate of well-qualified people. And that, I think, says some good things about Atlanta.
You know, I came to the end of one of the forums I moderated, and I said that very thing. I said, well, thank you all. And to the audience, you know, clearly we are lucky to have such a strong group of candidates up there. And I will not say who, but one of the candidates came up to me afterward and yelled at me and said, what do you mean? There are not a lot of good people here. I'm the only one. So, Jim, we can't win sometimes.
No, I don't think we're supposed to.
All right. That's about all the time we have today. I do want to point out, we've talked about President Trump earlier in the show. We talk about the fact that Wednesday is the one-year anniversary of the date that he was elected president of the United States. And we're going to talk a bit about how Georgia feels about the president 1 year after his election. Greg Bluestein will be with us. He and his colleague Tamar Hallerman did a piece in the Sunday paper after traveling around talking here in Georgia and talking up in Washington about it. So it's going to be, it was a good piece, I thought, Jim.
Yeah, there was a fellow named there, Brian Robinson, quoted
saying,
if you can't say that you voted for Donald Trump, you're not a Republican anymore.
That's not what I said.
No.
I said, don't bother running, you'll get crushed in a primary.
Okay, all right.
With that, Brian, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, Elena Parent. Look forward to talking to you a lot more as we get close to the legislative session. Jim Galloway, I'll see you again on Friday. Laura Wessel, thank you for coming in to keep me company here in the Savannah Studios. We enjoyed having you on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Okay. I want a couple of quick items before we leave you today. I want to make note just very quickly. On Saturday night, I had what I thought was a real privilege. I was invited to be the host, the master of ceremonies, for an annual gala that's hosted by the Islamic Speakers Bureau, which is an organization that works very hard to try to talk to people in our community about the true nature of Islam. They go into schools, they go to various community centers. They're out there trying to make sure people understand that Islam is not the religion that it sometimes is portrayed as by extremists. They gave a Lifetime Achievement Award to Arthur Blank. Mr. Blank took it very seriously. He brought his whole family to celebrate with him. And they gave a Courage Award to Sally Yates. And both Arthur and Sally Yates gave just lovely speeches about the importance of us learning in these very divisive times to try to live together more peaceably, with more respect for one another. And I just wanted to mention it and congratulate the Islamic Speakers Bureau for what I thought was an exceptional night. And it is exactly the kind of conversation we try to have here, respectful and collegial every day, unless Brian Robinson is in fine form. But we forgive him because he's a good guy. So, again, congratulations to the Islamic Speakers Bureau and to Arthur Blank and Sally Yates on their awards. That's about it for us. I appreciate Tom Faust back in Atlanta, Olivia Rheingold, Tyler Morris. Thank you for holding down the fort. I'm going to get in the car, head back up north as quickly as I can. I'll see you all back here on Wednesday at 2 o'clock for another Political Rewind. Take care.